Okay, so this week's parsha is Mishpatim. And, you know, immediately when we start learning the parsha, you get a sense that there is some type of continuity from the Aseret HaDivrot, which means it doesn't sound like it's completely new topics on the one hand. On the other hand, it's not exactly the same as the mitzvot that are written in the Aseret HaDivrot. So if we'll just like pause for that for a second, just make a little or a couple of observations about it. One observation is the going back to the very nature of the Aseret HaDivrot. You know, for us, and when I say for us, I mean for Jews and maybe even for the entire Judeo-Christian outlook, we tend to look at the quote-unquote Ten Commandments as being of some kind of prime importance. As far as internally within Jewish tradition, I'm not aware of any kind of an attitude that these particular ten mitzvot are deemed to be more important than other mitzvot. I mean, there is something special about them, without any question, but to say that they are, by definition, these are the more important mitzvot, I'm not, as I said, I'm not aware of such teaching. The second thing is that, you know, even though we call it Aseret HaDivrot, as far as I'm aware, there's actually no place that they're actually called Aseret HaDivrot. The closest is in Sefer Devarim, they're called actually Aseret HaDvarim, it's called, but not the Dibrot. The sense that we get, and Rashi says this clearly, is that these may not necessarily be 10 specific mitzvot as much as they may be 10 categories. You know, one exercise, if you choose to do it, you could try to compare the Aseret HaDivrot versus the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. You know, at face value, someone would be tempted to say that, oh, Jews have 613 commandments and non-Jews only have 7 commandments, and look at the huge disparity between the two. I just happen not to think that that's necessarily true, because I think a better comparison would be between the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, if you know them, by the way, and the Aseret HaDivrot. I should actually add that, if you know those, by the way. So to make the comparison between those two would probably be a much tighter comparison, and one which probably is very instructive, because if we go back and say, like Rashi's quotes from Sad Yagon, that the Aseret HaDivrot are in actuality categories of law, which means ultimately all areas of theft that we may find afterwards goes into Lo Tignov. Even though all of you, if I were to ask you, what does Lo Tignov mean, you would be very clever and tell me, oh, Lo Tignov means that you shouldn't kidnap. Correct? That's what you would have told me? Yes, because you're all very clever. The Rambam apparently wasn't as clever. When the Rambam writes in Hilchot Gneva, he says, well, how do you know you shouldn't steal? He says, because it says Lo Tignov. Hold it. Doesn't the Rambam know it's kidnapping? So there you have a very interesting question. Why in the world the Rambam... And by the way, the easiest thing is just to change it. Just say, oh, he made a mistake. He means Lo Tignovu from Parshat Kedoshim. I don't think that's the case. I think that the Rambam, and I'll pause here for a second, I think that the Rambam's use of psukim is itself interesting, that the Rambam often will not go and tell us a drasha that exists within Chazal. The Rambam will look for a pasuk which may express it in the clearest possible way. So again, if you were to ask, now again, not people who sit and learn yeshiva, because what do they know? If you were to ask any ganenet, how do you know you shouldn't steal? She'll say, because it says, Lo Tignov, it says in the Aseret HaDivrot, you shouldn't steal. Ask any mother, ask anybody, you know, ask a cab driver, how do you know you shouldn't steal? It says, because it says Lo Tignov. So now, we of course think that we're far more intelligent and educated than all of them, but maybe they're onto something. As I said, they all have the Rambam to support them. But maybe the issue really is that there's a couple of different ways of looking at the psukim. One is, what's pshat in the pasuk? Which is, what does this pasuk mean? And when I say pshat, that itself we could probably spend a lot of time trying to figure out what the phrase pshat means. But I would even say pshat should mean, what does it mean contextually? What is the contextual meaning of this particular verse? Do you like that definition of pshat? What is the, not what's the literal meaning, because literal meaning doesn't necessarily help you. What is the contextual meaning of this word, this phrase, this verse? So, contextually, Lo Tignov most likely means not to steal. It's true that the Gemara comes and tells us that in order to make it into the Aseres HaDibros, there needs to be a certain punishment which is connected to them, and therefore the punishment which is connected to them should be a punishment which is punishable by death. So therefore, how can this be the simple, regular stealing? So therefore, it's better to claim that it's talking about kidnapping, so we all understand the larger process. But at the end of the day, does that remove Lo Tignod from meaning that you shouldn't steal? So what I'm suggesting is that it could be that when we're trying to understand pshat in the pasuk, it may not necessarily be the same result as trying to figure out what the halacha tells us to do with it. Yeah.
Isn't it potentially mentioned most of yourself and most of them?
Yeah.
There's all talking about people. Doing something to another person.
Right.
So wouldn't textually imply that
it's a fair suggestion, but it's also next to other things. It's next to Shabbos. So I'm just saying it's next to honor. Okay. But I can still say it's something that I do to somebody. I steal from them. I don't say I steal them. I steal from them. It can also be. So when we start Mishpatim, then the question should be, okay, now, again, as I said, this is an exercise. I say, lo sikna evid ivri, so which one of the Aseres HaDibros is that connected to? So I actually can have two candidates for that, at least. What would the two candidates be? Okay, one candidate. Okay, it's a completely new idea. No, one is that I could potentially connect it to Anochi. Why? Because how does God introduce himself with Anochi? I am God who... And just realize there are a couple of different possibilities. One possibility could have been I'm God who created heaven and earth. Instead, God says, I'm God who took you out of Egypt, which is very interesting because it's really, what have you done for me lately? You know, who cares you created everything? What's the more personal relationship? Which and if it would have said I'm God who created heaven and earth, then what would you say? Then you'd also give me an explanation, right? Right. So I didn't say it's ridiculous. I just said it's interesting. But when it says I took you out of servitude, so over here to have Elam Mishpatim start with one of servitude, so it makes sense. I can also say Shabbos is somehow connected to leaving Egypt and to leaving a house of slavery, so therefore I can also potentially could have connected that. The Shabbos argument is actually a pretty good argument. Give me a second reason. Because the 6 years in working, the seventh year go free, then it can be connected to Shabbos. So over here, as I said, just as a task, take the mitzvot and mishpatim, line up the Aseret HaDibrot, and then just start working and say, you know, where should I put this into? And as we've seen, there could always be a possibility that it belongs in perhaps more than one place, and I don't have to limit myself to only one. Excuse me? Who? No, Rav Sadia goes to something else. He says that all 613 are included within the Ten Commandments. That's what he says. But he doesn't do this with Mishpatim as we're doing it. So what I'm saying is that if all 613 are within the 10, now let's look in Mishpatim and see which ones are there, and you're going to notice that you will have a very easy time taking the mitzvot of Mishpatim and putting them within the Aseret HaDibrot, which means the argument that the Mishpatim is really the extension. You know, let's go a little bit further. One of the really challenging issues, which I don't plan on dealing with today, is because I've dealt with it in other times, and therefore it doesn't interest me that much. And that is trying to figure out the sequence of the events. I mean, the real challenge is figuring out when the events of Perek Yutet took place, which is, as far as we're concerned, it's the chapter leading up to Matan Torah, when chapter Kaf took place, that's the chapter of Matan Torah, and when chapter Kaf Dalet, 24, takes place, and that also seems to be Matan Torah. So we have Yutet, Kaf, and then we have Kafaf. Naaseh v'nishma is all the way out there in Kafaf. Naaseh is in Yutet. So again, what's going on? What's the division over here? And more notably, why are these three chapters stuck in over here? So of course, you're all going to tell me, because as we've already established that you're very clever, you're all going to tell me that Rashi says, Ein mukdama mukha l'Torah. So there, now you've solved all problems in the history of the world because there's Ein mukdama mukha. But that doesn't solve anything, really. That just means that I shouldn't fall off my chair that things are not in sequence, if in fact they're not in sequence. But that doesn't explain why they're not in sequence. The Ramban, what does he say about Mukhtam Mukha? Does he believe that the Torah is in the proper sequence? Of course not. The Ramban also doesn't say, but the Ramban says, unless it says it clearly. I mean, the Ramban doesn't think, the Ramban doesn't see that as a weapon in his arsenal just to pull out when anything is a little awkward. The Ramban would admit there are certain things, by the way, you can't fight with this. There are psukim in the beginning of Bamidbar which are not in sequence. There's absolutely nothing you can do about it when you have the second month of the second year coming before the first month of the second year. There's just nothing. There's no amount you can argue with me is going to help you any, because it's just there's nothing to say. And the Ramban, of course, knows this. So the Ramban also would say ein muktam amuchar, but he would only say that when he has no other choice and it's clearly in the text. Rashi will just pull it out whenever he feels like pulling it out. I don't mean to be so flippant, but for Rashi, as I said, it is a weapon within his arsenal. So over here, presumably, if he was standing here, and I would ask Rashi, hold it, what's going on? Okay, ein muktam amuchar. Now, that doesn't really help me so much because I still now have to wonder, so hold it, but what is the nature over here of these couple of chapters? Perek Kaf Aleph Kapet and Kaf Gimel. Why are these chapters over here? If I do claim that on some level these three chapters, all the laws of Mishpatim, are really an extension of the Sereta Dibrot, then I can therefore say, who cares the sequence of the things taking place? What I have over here is instead an educational message or a teaching tool going on, a Sereta Dibrot, and now I need Mishpatim, and realize that these things really are connected. Ve'elah Mishpatim. I mean, right, you all notice the connection. Ve'elah Mishpatim. And these are the Mishpatim. Which Mishpatim? These are the Mishpatim connected to the Sereta Dibrot, so therefore there would seem to be some kind of a connection. And as I said, as you read through, learn through, listen to the Kriyat Torah, it's just something you can be processing and trying to figure out that connection. What I intimated before is that if the Sereta Dibrot are really, each one contains within them 20, 30, 40 different commandments, all laws of stealing on gluten, lo tignob, all types of laws regarding taking life or lo tirtzach, all of the arayot are considered are included within the Sereta Dibrot. Once I say that, then perhaps I should say the exact same thing when it comes to the Shev Mitzvah Be'Noach. These are not seven specific laws, these are categories of law. And if these are categories of law, so then, again, if each one of these also has 20, 30 different laws within each one, suddenly you're going to realize, okay, when it comes to non-Jews, there's no Tum and Tahara, there's no laws of Korbanot, there's no positive mitzvot, really, and there's no, what else do you take? But you still will be left probably with a ratio at the very end of the day, which is probably closer to 4-1 than 613-7. There's a book called The Seven Noahide Laws, I believe, written by somebody named Aaron Lichtenstein, who's a cousin of somebody named Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And I believe that I saw many years ago that he had that ratio at the end of 4-1, doing something very similar to what I just now did. Okay? And it's totally confusing because in the back it says he's a rabbi, a smicha, why you? And he went to Chaim Berlin, like almost everything biographical is the same, except it's a different person, and he spells his name differently. I think he spells Aaron with two A's instead of A-H. Okay? But he wrote a very nice book on the... It's also Rabbi Doctor, like everything. You'll be completely confused. Anyway, but he does do this ratio. So there are a couple of things that I want to look at, and one is something that I did speak about in the past, so I'm going to mention this more briefly, and if you really need to, you will find more about it. One of the troubling things, okay, if we can use the word troubling, is the whole law of ayin tachat ayin. Yes, is this troubling? Am I right? Am I wrong? Or yes, it's troubling, or is this not troubling? Why is it troubling? Because there actually could be two different reasons. Which one of those reasons bother you? Oh, that's what bothers you. Okay, I'm kidding. Say clearly what about this bothers you. Yes. Okay, it's a very good question. If, as Torah Shir Baal Peh teaches us, that this is talking about really paying money, so then why doesn't it just say paying money? You like the question or no? Excuse me? We learn things from everything, but you know the Gra on it? The Gra's in the Kol Yod. The Gra's great. I'll say the Gra. So then it's the only thing that'll interest you today. Everything else, everything else afterwards will just be, what should I say? Well, maybe icing on the cake. The Gross said that it says ayin tachat ayin. So he says, what do you pay for an ayin? You pay tachat ayin. So tachat ayin is underneath an eye. So he says, you look in the alphabet, the next letter in the alphabet after an ayin is a pay, after yud is a kaf, after nun is a samach. So he says, those are the same three letters as kesef. So he says, what's tachat ayin is kesef. Okay, so when you're the Vilna Gaon, then you can do these things at, as well. So he says, it says tachat ayin, it's kesef. It's black and white. The next letter after an ayin in the alphabet, you know, alphabet?
Yeah.
Alphabet, sorry. The letter after an ayin is a pei. The letter after yud is a kaf. Letter after a nun is a samach. So tachat ayin underneath an ayin is kesef. So what? That's not. Yeah, but then you say, okay, what's after Shane? Okay, I understand. But his point is very well taken, and you do have to admit it is somewhat impressive. So. There's actually two problems with it. One problem is that the halacha comes and says this is not what we do. So let's play it this way. The way that Christianity would attack us, they would say that Judaism is Old Testament, is full of anger, is full of judgment, is full of strictness. But after God became a family man, the New Testament, then God became a lot more user-friendly and nice and so on and so forth. And therefore, Christianity is a religion full of love, and Judaism is a religion which is full of stringency. The way I just now said it is actually very important, because that would be part of the tension going on within the Middle Ages. And then you would have then people coming back and saying, hold it a second. The Torah says an eye for an eye. And any attempt to change that is actually an attempt of changing the Torah. So basically, when the Torah was given, wherever it came from, that would continue the same line of reasonings, it really is quite primitive. The rabbis and the Mishnah, the Gemara, were a little bit more developed and sophisticated and decent. And therefore, they covered it up and they said, no, it really means money. Now, that's the way to say it, which is far more troubling. As I said, you have the theological issue compared to Christianity. You have this way of suggesting some kind of development took place. Torah says this. Torah Shebech Al-Peh says this, as if they come from two different places. If you want to throw icing on the cake, you also have the Code of Hammurabi, where the Code of Hammurabi also speaks about a type of an eye for an eye. So therefore, the Torah fits within the culture where it came from, and therefore it's very typical, and nothing's unique about it. And as I said, those are the ways of really bringing up this question in a much more troubling fashion. So there would need to be a couple of things that need to be done. One is the word tachat itself. Is it used in any other place in the Chumash? The answer is, of course it is. So where else is it used? That's much later. Earlier and better examples. Well, by Avram you have it by the Akedah even. You have the animal tachat beno, right? In place of. You have it already all the way back by Adam also, Cain. But the word doesn't mean an eye for an eye. It means an eye in place of an eye. So I'm just pointing that out, first of all. As far as we can tell, there never was a Beit Din that got up and said this is the proper punishment. And there never was a Beit Din that implemented ayin tachat ayin, which means this goes completely against Jewish tradition as far as we know. Again, you can say that this is the part of this whole great cover-up. I suspect most of you know the Mishnah, which tells us that Rabbi Kiva said that if he sat on a Beit Din, they never would have killed anybody. Again, Old Testament, killing left and right. And the reality that we learn about by the Mishnah is, what are you talking about? I'd cross-examine the witnesses. I would find that they really didn't know what they're talking about. So what do you do with something like this? And this, I mean, is a very sincere question. So I'm going to say this over in a brief way. If I had to, I can say this over in a much more developed way, but I just want to say it over basically. The only dissenting opinion we find in the Gemara is Rabbi Lezer. And Rabbi Lezer says, ayin tachat ayin, mamish. He says, really is ayin tachat ayin. The Gemara questions this and says, what are you talking about? Because the Gemara knows everything that I know, and that is that no one ever did it. How can Rabbi Lezer wake up one day, oh no, it really means it? So the Gemara then ends up saying something which is very clever. And based on this point of the Gemara, we're going to begin to unravel this. The Gemara says, what does it mean when it says, Aitachanayim Mamish? It means that I have to pay the value of the eye. Bless you. The question is, whose eye am I paying the value for? Which means, let's say, Reuven comes and knocks out the eye of Shimon. So, the reading of the Chumash itself would say to me that I now knock out Shimon's eye. Of course, you can all ask me a question. And what's the question? Yeah, and how does that help Reuven? And I say that as a very similar, very serious question. How did exactly that help Reuven? So you could tell me, well, he got his pound of flesh, and let's say it was an accident. He's negligent. Pound of flesh, you're on. He's negligent. So what did this really do for the victim? Maybe again, maybe he got a moment of joy out of it, but it really doesn't do very much for him at all. The Ibn Ezra brings up, and he quotes on this, but he brings up a fascinating question, why he thinks it can't be taken literally. He says, let's say somebody did not knock out an eye completely, he knocked out 80% of somebody's vision. Are you now going to knock out 80% of somebody else's vision? He just says, very impractical. Forget about anything else. He says, very impractical. You knock out 99% of a vision, not 100% of the vision. So then you knock out 99. The Rambam is very interesting, because the Rambam does something which he doesn't do usually. The Rambam, the Mishnah Torah, actually says the halacha. The halacha is that you pay mamon. And then the Rambam gives three different ways of understanding this in terms of telling you pshat in the pasuk. One of the things that the Rambam says is that it can't possibly be mamon. It can't possibly be literally you knock out an eye, because a couple of pasukim before it says that if you have people who are fighting, perek kaf aleph pasuk yud chet, v'chi yirivun anashim v'yika ish et reyo be'evin o be'egrov, v'lo yimut v'nafal mishkav, somebody causes damage to another person, im yakum v'telech b'chutz ha'meshanto v'nika ha'makeh, rak shifto yitain v'arper yirapeh. You pay him damages, and you pay him for his doctor's bills. You pay him damages. So the Chumash says that you pay damages and you pay doctor bills. How do you know? Because it just said that you hurt somebody. So one second. The continuation, shen tachat shen, right? Yad tachat yad, right? Petza tachat patza, chabura tachat chabura. There it says that you hurt somebody, a chabura. Petza. So this is the Rambam's argument. Rambam says, it can't possibly mean you do to him what he did to you, because the Pesukim just now said before that you're paying money. So therefore, when Torah Shabbat Peh insists it's the monetary value, remember what I said Pshat was? What would the Rambam say is Pshat, again, not reading one Pesuk by itself, Pshat reading a string of five or six or seven Pesukim together, he'd say Pshat of Ayin Tachat Ayin has to be that you pay money. That's the Rambam's argument over here, and look, I'm not gonna grade different people's answers. It's very compelling. I mean, the truth is, in my opinion, it's more compelling than the Ibn Ezra's argument. Ibn Ezra's argument: how do you figure out exactly when it's 80%? This is much better, because you can still say, okay, 80%, so then you pay money. You knock it 100%, so then you do knock it out, because then you do know. Which is why you give me the argument when you don't know. Give me the argument when you do know. But over here, the Rambam is saying, hold it. Look at the contextually. It said chabura tachet chabura, petza tachet petza. It just said beforehand, when you hurt somebody, you pay for the doctor bills and you pay for the and you pay money for it. So of course that's what it means. So let's go back to Rabbi Lezer. What did Rabbi Lezer say? Ayin tachet ayin mamish. So go back and ask the question again. When it says mamish, the Gemara then qualifies. No, it means the money, but the money of what? So now again, Reuven knocks out Shimon's eye. How much money does he pay? So here's the argument. Here's the maskana of the Gemara. The argument. Do you pay the value of Reuven's eye, or do you pay the value of Shimon's eye? So I'm going to say it again. Reuven knocks out Shimon's eye, you pay the value. Which value? So let's just say, again, for argument's sake, that one guy's a bricklayer and the other guy's a diamond cutter. So it could be that a bricklayer with bad vision, with one eye, can still be a bricklayer. A diamond cutter with one eye, that's going to cost him a lot of money a year in terms of his ability of cutting diamonds. As I said, just to give one small example. So over here now, the question comes, do I pay the damage that I've done, which, as I said, is really the way that most of the Chachamim understand it? The Lezer says, no, Ayin Tachat Ayin Mamish, which means, that, again, the Maskana of the Gemara, you pay the value not of the person who you damaged, you pay the value of your eye. Now, why would that be? Again, just go one step further. Why would that be? So you say, Kapa,
you really should lose your eye.
Okay. You deserve. Let's use the word deserve. It's like In terms of a perfect world, you did this, you deserve this, but what's the problem? We're not going to do it. Now, the Rambam, who I told you, gave three different arguments on why it can't possibly mean that you pay money. He says it's a Mesorah, Bishmi Moshe Rabbeinu, this Torah Shebal Peh. We've always known this. This is what it means. He gave the argument contextually how it can't be pshat any other way. Nonetheless, in the Mor Nevuchim, the Rambam wrote something completely different. And the Rambam writes, and he says a klal gadol. And this is the klal that we need to hear. Klal gadol, he writes, that when it comes to Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebal Peh, they have two different agendas. Torah Shebaal Peh tells you halacha, what it is you should do. Torah Shebaal Peh tells you machshava of way the world should work. Let me say this a little differently. Let's say a person is going to go off and, you know, he's going to spend time on a deserted island, and all they can bring is one book with them. Which book do you bring with you? Do you bring a Chumash or do you bring a Mishnah Berurah? So which one is going to tell you how you live your life as a Jew? At least Aruch Chaim. So the Mishnah Berurah is going to tell you what you do. You open up a Chumash by itself, what's it going to tell you? Again, I don't mean to knock the Chumash, an all-time bestseller. But what is the Chumash going to do for you in terms of living your life as a Jew? And the answer the Rambam will tell you, it won't tell you anything about how to live your life as a Jew, but it will tell you the values that a Jew should have. The Torah, Shebichsav, establishes values. So therefore, the Rambam, and this is the context, in terms of Ayin Tachat Ayin, the Rambam says, Klal Gadol, if you did something, you deserve the same thing. That's the way the world of punishment should work. On the other hand, we don't work it that way. So now, it's fascinating. In his Mishnah Torah, and again, let me preface this a little bit. As you learn, you're going to find time and time again that the Rambam manages to contradict himself all over the place. Between, let's say, the Perish Mishnayos till the Mishnah Torah, he contradicts himself hundreds of times. And that's easy. He wrote the Perish Mishnayos when he was around 20 years old, just if any of you want to feel inadequate. It wasn't his first book. First book he wrote when he was 16, it was a dictionary of philosophical terms. So now you can feel inadequate. So he then sat down and wrote the Perish Mishnayos, which I don't know if you ever used the Rambam Perish Mishnayos. It's probably, you know, till the 20th century, the most valuable parish. I'm afraid to really score points. You know, now we have things like Kahati and even Art Scroll is now putting out a Perish Mishnayos. The Rambam's Perish Mishnayos is fascinating. It's wonderful. It's thorough. And the truth is that everyone else uses it ever since then. Had the Rambam never written anything else other than the Perish Mishnayos, he would have been remembered as one of the great Rishonim. He then sits down and he writes the Sefer Mitzvahs, then he writes the Mishnah Torah. So Mishnah Torah is clearly his halachic magnum opus. On the other hand, he sits down and he also writes a great book known as the Mor Nevuchim. So now, the Mor Nevuchim and the Mishnah Torah are written in the latter part of the Rambam's life, not that different from one another. And the Mishnah Torah is written somewhat before, but others written right afterwards, but there's another point. It wasn't that he wrote it once and then he's finished. Till the end of his life, he's still going through manuscripts and he's still crossing out and he's still working on it for the rest of his life. Which means these two books are both sitting on his table. Even if I want to say he contradicts himself hundreds of times, and by the way, more often than not, the way he contradicts himself is that in his Perish Mishnayos, he generally took the accepted view, and by the time he got older, the Mishnah Torah, he's a bit more independent. That's really if I had to pick one thing as an overarching difference between the two, that's really the difference. When he's older, he's a little bit more independent. There are major contradictions between the Mor Nevuchim and between the Mishnah Torah. Now, some people will say the real Rambam is the one of the Mor Nevuchim. Others will say, no, the real Rambam is the Mishnah Torah. Now, having learned with Rabbi Soloveitchik, I can assure you that he felt not only was the real Rambam the Mishnah Torah, he actually thought the Mishnah Torah was more successful in terms of Jewish philosophy than the Mor Nevuchim was, which I think would surprise some people. The Rav has a book which nobody understands. I'm sorry if I'm insulting the three people who understand it or may listen to this one day. And that is a book which is called The Halachic Mind. If you know a great deal of philosophy of science, not just philosophy and not science, but philosophy of science, then this is the book for you to read. at the very end of it, he talks about this, how the Rambam, he believes, was more successful in enunciating a Jewish philosophy in the Mishneh Torah than he was within the Morne Vilchim. Now, as I said, certain people say the real Rambam is the Mishneh Torah, others say the real Rambam is the Morne Vilchim, and my point is he wrote it at the same time. What's the difference? The difference is when he, in his introduction to the Morne Vilchim, he apologizes a little bit, which gives you the sense that it is, to at least a certain extent, apologetics. Okay? So I'm just mentioning that as a possibility. This whole question will become much more profound when and if we deal with the question of korbanos. Because, as everybody knows, the Rambam writes in the Morne Vilchim how korbanos is something which God realized humans have the need, and therefore he allowed korbanos to take place. Somebody interviewed me this morning on a radio program, and he just said, oh, the Rambam says this. I said, that's wonderful. And he gave me this whole learned philosophy of how the Rambam did not believe korbanos came, and therefore there won't be korbanos in the future. I said, that's very nice, except for one problem. The Rambam writes in multiple places that when Mashiach comes, he's going to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash and he's going to bring korbanos. The Rambam went out of his way to write a whole sefer korbanos, whole sefer in Beis HaBechira. Meaning, if the Rambam never wrote that, none of you would be troubled. Do you hear what I'm saying? If the Rambam only dealt with practical halacha that applies today, like the Rif did, nobody would say, oh, why aren't you right about that? So why would the Rambam, who theoretically never believed there would ever be korbanos, goes and sits down and writes a whole book about korbanos? One second, you hear my question? Why go out of his way and say multiple times that this is what one of the things Melech Mashiach has to do, is to bring korbanos? So what do you do? And what happens at the end of Hilchos Me'ilah where he writes korbanos or a chok? He says it's a chok. Hold it, didn't you just write, aren't you the same one who wrote in the Morne Vilchim that it's because humans had a need and whatever? So apparently, that's what he wrote, is Dama Shatoshiv. What do you really believe? The Rambam writes a chok, which means the Rambam apparently feels comfortable with explaining certain things in a way. Over here, when it comes to Ayin Tachat Ayin, the Rambam gives us this unbelievable approach and tells us that Torah Shebichsav is not to teach us halacha. Torah Shabbat Peh teaches you halacha. A Mishnah can teach you halacha. Chumash doesn't teach you halacha. By the way, have you ever seen anybody paskin a halacha when they open up a Chumash? Have you seen somebody paskin a halacha by opening a Rambam? Yeah. Opening a Shulchan Aruch? Yeah. Shas and Chubas? Yeah. A Mishnah Brewer? Yeah. Chumash? No. Why not? It's not a book of halacha. Yeah. What happened? Excuse me? So, in this particular case, I don't have to say he's contradicting himself, but when it comes to halacha, the Rambam says nobody can possibly debate that a Beis Din cannot go and say, we're knocking out your eye because you knocked out his eye. When it comes to halacha, there's no debate. That's the point. When it comes to Jewish philosophy, when it comes to analyzing the verses, Psukim, understanding what it's about. He says the Psukim are there to teach you values which are independent from what it says, which means it's not a process whereby, oh, the rabbis in the old days or whoever wrote the Torah used to be really mean-spirited and so on and very primitive. And then the rabbis got a little bit more developed and therefore then they didn't like this old stuff and there's a change. No. Misinai, we receive both Torah Shabbat and Torah Shabbat Peh. And if Misinai, they say the exact thing, then why do we need both? I don't know if that sounds like a question. Why do you need both? Because they're not there to teach you the exact same thing. Torah Shebichsav, what the Rambam writes, is there to teach you values. Torah Shebaal Peh is there to teach you how you go about implementing the values, how to implement the halacha. What is the value, therefore? And again, that's why I hear an echo of Rabbi Eliezer here. What is the value? The value is, if you knocked out an eye, you deserve to lose your eye. If a Beis Din ever does it, Chas V'Shalom. Chas V'Shalom, if a Beis Din ever to do it. I don't know if they're both for laymen. Remember that he wrote the Mishneh Torah in Hebrew, which already means it's somewhat for the scholar. His other books till this point, Perush Mishnayos and the Sefer HaMitzvos and the Morne Vilchim, they're all written in Arabic. So whether he's writing them for the same audience or not, I'm not completely convinced. And you can tell me, no, he wrote the Mishneh Torah for the layperson, I'm not convinced of that either. Because then why write it in Hebrew? He should have written this in Arabic easier, which theoretically was easier for him. I say theoretically. I mean, it's very hard for me to say. The Rambam was probably a very impressive individual. So it's hard to say easier, not easier. But he did go out of his way to write all his other major works were all written in Arabic. This he wrote in Hebrew. So apparently he does not have the same audience. Well, it depends. He also wrote a letter where somebody called him on this, and he says, no. He goes, what should you do? You should learn the Gemara, learn the Rif, then learn my Sefer. And first of all, he says, you'll see I always agree with the Rif. That he always agrees with the Rimagash is another thing. He thinks he always agrees with the Rif. And he says, and then you'll learn and you understand it. By the way, the Smag, for example, right? Familiar? The Smag apparently used the Rambam left and right, not for the halacha, but for his language, which means the Rambam went and took all of the Talmud Bavli and put it into Hebrew, very clear Hebrew. So when the Smag is sitting and writing and trying to explain what the various halachas, he cuts and pastes Rambams and puts it into each and every mitzvah over there in order to make it, again, the Rambam made learning very, very easy by putting it, he wrote his other books in Arabic, but Hebrew is easier than Aramaic. To what extent people knew Aramaic is also somewhat of a question. Okay. Let's move on to another example. Towards the beginning of the parasha, after slavery, and by the way, the slavery over here should not be understood as slavery as much as to be understood as a prison. This is instead of prison. Similarly, when you have the person who kills inadvertently and he goes off and into galut, that's also seen as some kind of a prison. Which means, you know, those of you who are brought up in America and therefore are under the belief that America is the greatest country and one of full of freedoms and so on, it's true. It's true that America has a great deal of freedoms, but the problem is, and the greatest freedom, of course, the most basic freedom, is freedom of movement. You can go wherever you want. On the other hand, America has more people sitting in prisons, incarcerated, and therefore have lost freedom of movement than any other country, both in terms of absolute numbers and in terms of percentage, which means, you know, whenever you have these hostile, backward regimes who are being lectured to by America, they turn back and say to America, well, why exactly do you have so many people sitting in prison? What happened to your system over here? You know, this doesn't seem to be working very well, and you keep taking away all these freedoms, which means certain people have the freedoms, and by the way, let's be honest about another thing. In America, the percentage of people who are certain minorities who are sitting in those prisons is also disproportionate. Now, you can all tell me, yeah, it's disproportionate, because they're disproportionate in terms of the people that are doing crimes, although we all know that if you can afford a good lawyer, you're getting off of those same crimes, and you're not going to be sitting as long in prison, and you will be getting more convenient punishments. So as much as I'm not complaining about the system, I'm just pointing out some things. Again, if you want to complain a little bit more in terms of Mishpatim, you can complain in terms of the beauty of America is that it believes in democracy. I mean, democracy is a very nice thing. But it also could be understood as a little silly. Jefferson had a hard time with this. I mean, why in the world should an illiterate person have the same vote as somebody who is a college graduate? Now, modern times seems to point out that the illiterate person may be smarter than the college graduate. And, I mean, that's also, it depends what they're being taught in college and who they're being taught by. And the only people worse than the college graduates are the college professors. And I say that having taught in college for over 20 years. So, but to say that everybody should have an equal vote, that's something which is a little disturbing. But go a little bit further to another ramification of the same issue when you have something which is called trial by peers, right? So therefore, you take a jury, you put it in, because again, a trial by peers is that somebody who is a peer of that individual, they're the ones who should decide ultimately this individual's guilt or non-guilt. Now, just pause for a second. You have within the courtroom, you have a defense attorney who's being paid to get the guy off the hook. So he's not looking for truth, correct? You have a prosecuting attorney, district attorney, who is also not necessarily looking for truth. He's looking for convictions. That's part of his job, especially if he gets elected and so on. Yes, is that okay so far? Mm-hmm. My daughter-in-law is supposed to start working for the attorney general in Israel on Supreme Court cases. So I'll ask her if this is really the case that they just, you know, have to get your convictions, or they're looking for. So far you have the two people who defense attorney, prosecuting attorney, they're not necessarily looking for truth to come out. They're there to defend their sides. The judge, now this also comes down, maybe, theoretically a judge who's looking for truth, but again, is this judge being elected, reelected, whatever? I mean, what exactly position is he in? So we'll leave the question to the judge. But you take the people who have no legal training, you take people who are the least capable, and you put them in, and anybody who may actually have an opinion, you get rid of them during jury selection, and they're the ones who will decide if the person is guilty or not. Now, the beauty of this is, again, a trial by peers, because America believes in democracy and therefore believes that the peers do have this some type of innate wisdom. I mean, maybe they believe that they have cited the Shemaya. I don't know. But if you think about it, you have a legal system. Right? Do you understand the problem with this? The problem is that you have a number of people who are well-trained but not looking for truth. You have people who are not trained who are theoretically looking for truth, but they're not trained. So how is this supposed to work? Within the Beis Din, you have a situation, no lawyers are allowed. By the way, that's probably the best way of getting truth. I know, I'll tell you something which is scary again. So here's the second thing that you'll remember from today's class. So somebody was having some kind of a conflict with somebody else, and he came to me to ask me advice and to ask me what to do and asking for a psak. So the first thing you need to know, when somebody's having a fight with somebody else and they come to you, or they come to me at least, I can't give a psak when it's having somebody else money with somebody else. Why can't I give a psak? Because I only heard one side. And any rabbi who ever says, oh, this is what happened, this is what you should do, is guilty of malpractice. You can't decide a monetary issue when you only heard one side of it. Because every time I've heard two sides of it, one side has nothing to do with the other side. They have two different narratives, two different completely. So he came over to me and he told me, so I suggested, I said, so why don't you go over and go to a Beis Din, you know? So he goes, Beis Din, and this is a frum guy, Beis Din, no way in the world. So what? So he told me that that a couple of years before he had a business partner, and the partner stole his business from him. Okay, without any details, if I actually told you who it was, you would know. But he stole the business. You know what the business is, at least. He stole the business. So they got into a disagreement. Another guy said, okay, I'm taking you to Beis Din, and said, okay, you have to come. And let's just say that one lived in two cities. One lived in Yerushalayim and one lived in Tel Aviv. So the one in Yerushalayim said, so you should come to Yerushalayim, to my Beis Din. So the guy from Tel Aviv goes to his rabbi and says, he told me I have to come to the Beis Din. He goes, no, if he's suing you, then he has to come to where you are. He has to come to Tel Aviv. Now, meanwhile, he had sent him a hazmana to the Beis Din. The Beis Din had three different rabbis on the name over there, and he had to come to this Beis Din with these three rabbis. Okay, his rabbi said, no, you're not going there. You tell him that if he wants, he has to come to the Beis Din where you are. So he comes to that Beis Din. Who shows up with him? One of the three Dayanim comes up as his lawyer. Should I say this again? One of the three Dayanim when he had invited him to come to Beis Din now shows up to the other Beis Din as this guy's lawyer. What's the matter? What don't you understand? What? One of the judges from the original shows up as the lawyer. So the Beis Din in the city that he was in looked at the guy and said, thank you very much. You can wait outside till we're finished. And didn't let him walk into the court. But that's why this guy didn't want to go to Beis Din. He goes, are you kidding? This is absolutely corrupt. And by the way, as much as people complain about the Rabbanut and the Bati Din in Israel, the Bati Din in America are far, far, far more frightening to me. And I can give you many, many reasons why, but I'll just leave it at that. That the profound need to totally overhaul Bat Din all over the place, which is, we have a good system. We've just been entrusting it in people, because anybody can just say, okay, three of us, okay, we're based in now, and we can just do anything that we want, unfortunately. So, if somebody, let's try to now move all the way back. The way the Beis Din is supposed to work is you have 23 judges, let's say in a Beis Din of 23, and they have to work both as prosecuting attorneys and as defense attorneys. We're told in capital cases, if they come up and all 23 vote that the guy's guilty, he goes off free, because that means he didn't get a defense. which means the judges who are trained are the ones who among themselves have to both prosecute and defend, and if they don't do both, then they haven't done their job, which means you keep the lawyers outside of the courtroom, which, as you see, is probably a very good idea. And I think that meaning, just because it used the word evid over here, be careful. Be careful. We need definitions of each thing. So as I said, there's one more thing that I wanted to look at. Over here we have a situation of somebody, let's Perikov Aleph Pasuk Yudalit. Immediately prior to this, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, it had spoken about somebody who had killed by accident, and that person has to run away. And that, so as I said, I see the running away as some kind of a prison sentence, but better than a prison sentence. Because he's here, he'll take his family. Same thing with slavery, by the way. He could take his family with him, and he has works, pays off the person. The person who was damaged gets paid off, and you don't have the same kind of trauma, and it's not the state. Again, today, if somebody steals money, so okay, he goes to prison. The person who was stolen from never gets his money back. Over here, he has to work to pay back the money. So again, it should be seen within the larger legal system. Now, Pasuk Yudalad reads, V'chi yazid ish arayehu lahargo ba'arma me'im mizbechi tekachenu lamut. Somebody who does, not by accident, on purpose, premeditated murder, that person, it says, that you take him away from the Mizbeach. Now, that's such an interesting turn of phrase. And over here, we have to pause again. You know, one of the things the Gemara tells us is that when, again, it's this strange scene. It says that when the Aseres HaDibros started to be said, the first one, Anochi Hashem, Lo Yelecha, and so on, it says that when, you know, the first edition of the newspapers came out the next day, the editorial was, same old religion. He's only interested in his own glory. It's all about me, 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 and that's like every other god. And then he got to which mitzvah was a complete game changer, and that was when we got to Kavedes Avich V'Simecha. Honor, hold it. Instead of just honoring God, honor somebody else, another human being. And then it moves on to Lotir Tzach and all the interpersonal. So at that point, there's something completely different that changed. By the way, including comparing it to any type of religion which had existed prior to this. And that is that there is a concern not just for Bein Adam L'Makom, as it were, but also Bein Adam L'Chaveru. Now that's why this is fascinating, because we see over here a weaving together of the Bein Adam L'Makom and the Bein Adam L'Chaveru together. Which means, again, the person who's holding on to the Mizbeach, what can he say? He can say, first of all, he can be involved in avoda. I can be doing religious work. Secondly, I can, holding on to the Mizbeach, and saying, this is, you know, I'm in a religious place. How dare you, meaning I'm a religious person. How dare you try to punish me for this? By the way, who was the person in Tanakh who goes and holds on to the Mizbeach? Who?
Yoav.
So one second. Did Yoav know the halacha? Actually, I found the Gemara. The Gemara in Bava Basra indicates that he didn't know the halacha. Not this halacha. It talks about a different halacha. I'll read this Gemara just because it's interesting. Oh, there's another Gemara I wanted to tell you also. Tov. See. First the other Gemara, and then I'll come back to this one. The other Gemara is somebody... I mean, I already gave an answer to this, so I'm sorry for doing this in the middle. This goes back to what I said before. Why didn't the Torah just say, pay the money for knocking out an eye? Right. Pay the money. So I really did explain that it's trying to teach you a value, that this is what you deserve. That's what comes out from the Rambam. There's actually a very funny Gemara. When I say funny, it actually is amusing. It says that there was somebody by the name of Hanan Bisha. Hanan Bisha, you've heard of Hanan Bisha. What Gemara are you learning? Okay. So he's actually mentioned twice there in the Gemara. Once in Baba Kama. Once is this story, and the other one is when he says he's a scoundrel, but he's not a thief. He's not a nice person. The Gemara tells us over there a tale. Then, if you remember it, it says that he punched somebody and he caused damages. He goes to court, and he says you have to pay half of whatever the denomination was. But he only has a broken coin, and not such a nice coin, and no one's willing to give him change. So he's stuck with this coin. So no one's giving him change. So he turns to the guy and he smacks him another time, and he says, "Here's the whole coin already." So now, obviously, there's something a little cynical there, but if the Torah said, if you punch somebody in the nose, you have to pay 5 shekel for it, you're going to be mad at somebody. Take a look. You look in your wallet, you look at the guy, you say, hold on a second, hold this, and then you hit him. And morally, you would say there's nothing wrong with that. Over here, by saying ayin tachat ayin, it really is creating more of a moral issue that you deserve something which is far more profound. And I think that Gemara Chanan Bisha really helps explain this this idea of ayin tachat ayin and why it doesn't write it that way. Okay, so that's one thing. Secondly, there is, as I said, this Gemara which may not be amusing. It's a Gemara in Baba Batra. It's on Daf Kaf Aleph, and it's discussing over here what's better: to hire a teacher who covers lots and lots of ground but makes occasional mistakes, or somebody who goes very slowly but makes no mistakes whatsoever. So what's a better teacher? What would you rather have? Lot of ground, no mistakes, or slowly? Sorry, lot of ground and mistakes, or slowly but no mistakes. What would you prefer as a teacher? So it's machlokas. Excuse me? It's machlokas. The Gemara says, I'm a Rava. Hani tre makri dardiki. Chad garis below dayik, v'chad dayik below garis. So that's the Gemara. So the Gemara says, who do you use? Motvina nahu de garis below dayik. You take the guy who covered ground, and even if he doesn't pay so much attention. Rav Dimi minahu do amar motvina de dayik below garis. No, you take the guy who's really careful, even if he's. You take the guy who's really careful, even if he doesn't go so quickly. It then goes on and tells a story about. It quotes a pasuk and goes and tells a story about Yoav. Different halacha. It says, I'll read the pasuk. Ki sheshet chodoshim yoshav shem Yoav v'chol Yisrael al hichrid kol zacher be'edom. 6 months he got rid of all the males. Ki ato lekamei de David amar lei. My time it goes, now it's kafal from the bed. My time of adat hachi, why do you get rid of all the males? Amar lei dechtiv. It says, timcha et zacher amalek. It says, get rid of all the males from amalek. By the way, the Gemara doesn't have the nikud here. But this is also involved in the whole discussion. Is it Zecher or Zecher? The Gemara over here at Zachar. Kill all the males. So, Amar Lei, Bohanan Zecher Karinan. David HaMelech says, but it says Zecher. I believe the Ritva on the Gemara over here says Zecher. It says Zecher. Just in case you want to know, Zecher is. He says, but the Torah says Zecher. What are you talking about? Amr Lei Lididi Zachar Karinan. He goes, the way that I learn, it's Zachar, and therefore I kill the males. Azo Shaili L'Rabbi. He went and asked his Rebbe. Amr Lei Hachiak Ritunan. How do you read it? Amr Lei. So now there's actually two different characters of the Gemara. But it sounds like he says, Timchad Zachar Malik. His Rebbe tells him, it's Zachar. So it says, he curses him out, and there's two different conclusions of the Gemara. One is that he killed him, and one that he only threatened to kill him. But over here you have Yoav, who had a bad Rebbe. That's exactly the context over here. Yoav had a bad Rebbe, so it's very possible he didn't know the halacha. So therefore, when he's chased down, what does he do? He holds on to the Mizbeach, not realizing it's not going to help him. Why won't it help him? Because it says it's not going to help you, that you go and you take somebody like this even away from the Mizbeach. So again, the fact that it talked about Yoav's, I guess this is important, if you want to sue your Rebbe for malpractice, or kill him for malpractice, as the case may be. So this would be... significant. So if Yoav is your Rebbe, you have the heter. So, very quickly, why I think this is interesting. One is the whole interaction between the Mizbeach and between murder. Secondly, again, if that doesn't make sense, maybe we'll try it like this. Why are you not allowed to kill somebody? Or murder somebody, even better. Why are you not allowed to? So what's the right answer to that question? Because it says, lo tirtzach. That's the right answer. However, it doesn't only say lo tirtzach, it also says another pasuk. What's the other pasuk that it says? Shofech adam b'adam b'moy shofech, ki b'tzel malakim asos adam. Right back in Perek Tes and Bereishis. That why shouldn't you kill somebody? You shouldn't kill somebody because he's b'tzel malakim. Now, the truth is, it's very interesting. You know, sometimes you look for Tamei HaMitzvot. Over here it says, keep it selma kim, because man is the image of God, and therefore it's inappropriate to kill. Now, one half a step further back, when man is created, and this goes all the way back to Perek Bet Pasuk Zayin, it says, V'yitzar Hashem l'kim as Adam ofer min Adama. The God created man. Man is essentially a hybrid. What are we a hybrid between? Between this breath of God and between, right? V'yipach ba'ab, v'yitzar Hashem es Adam ofer min Adama, v'yipach ba'ab, nishmat chayim, v'yadam l'nefesh chaya. Man is this hybrid between being from the dust of the earth, as it were, or Adam and Adama, and on the other hand, he is from the breath of God. So, therefore, what would you say? We're a little spiritual and we're a little physical. So Rashi then, and this is really based upon Yerushalmi and Nazir, Rashi says, Afromin Adama, he gives two opinions. One, Tzavar Afromi Kol Ha'adamami Arba Ruchot, man is created from the earth, from the four corners of the earth, Shekol Makom She'emucham Tehei Kol Tato L'Kvura. That is very depressing, but maybe it's, Rashi didn't think it was depressing, that if you die, any place that you die, the earth can then take you back, because you come from all four corners of the earth. Then Rashi says, Dabar Acher, Natal Afro Mimokum Shenemarbo, Mizbeach Adama Ta'aseli. Now, I don't know if you remember where that pasuk was, Mizbeach Adama Ta'aseli. It's actually, where is it? It's at the very end of last week's parsha, which is also a little strange. Like, why in the world was this stuck in at the end of the Seres HaDibrot? It brings in Mizbeach Adama Ta'aseli. It also says, Vizavachta Lavet Elotecha. Right, and so on. Next pasuk says, "M'zachavanim taseli lo tivne etem gazit ki char b'chay naftala v'techalea." Don't use a sword when you make the mizbeach. So now I want to put all these things together. Don't use a sword when you make a mizbeach. Why? The Mechilta says a mizbeach gives life and a sword brings death. Good. Mizbeach gives life by bringing kapar. Mizbeach, the Mechilta says, gives life and a sword causes death. A mizbeach is made out of the Adama, and man is made out of the Adama. So therefore, what Rashi is telling us over here, as I said, is based on the Yerushalmi, what it's telling us over here is that man himself is made of the same thing as the Mizbeach. So a person who takes a life and tries to hold on to the Mizbeach, he can't hold on to this Mizbeach, which is made out of, in a certain sense, the same thing where the Tzelem Elokim eventually came from. By the way, the other thing that I would then point out is that what I said before, I'm correcting myself now, you would say that we have the spiritual part, the breath of God, and we have this physical part, which comes, so what is Rashi now telling us? Even the physical part that we have comes from the base of Mikdash. You know, instead of saying we are, this is far too old for you, we are stardust, right? We are, no, you don't know this. What? We are stardust. We were part. No, we are part of the Mizbeach. We are part the way the Yerushalmi. We are part of the Beis Hamikdash. That's the physical part of us. The physical part of us is holiness, and then certainly when you take the spiritual part as well. So therefore, when you look at this pasuk over here, that a person who kills and therefore they destroyed at Tzelem Elokim, that person can't hold on to the Mizbeach, because the Mizbeach itself is part of the same stuff which a person is made of, and therefore this whole then. Ben Adam L'Makom, Ben Adam L'Chaveiro becomes so much more intertwined and interesting than the way we would normally look at, oh, these are mitzvot with God and these are mitzvot with man, that even when it comes to what man is, that man is something which is B'Tzelem Elokim, and therefore we really need to hesitate before we draw an absolute distinction between those types of mitzvot. But what I think that we have, again, much more clarity in terms of this mitzvot. Don't, even from a mizbeach, you take away the person who was guilty of murder, because now we understand the mizbeach itself is really where man came from, and that's where our whole Tzelem Elokim came from as well, and this person went and destroyed that. Okay.